Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. And with me today, I have Kelly Goumont. How are you, Kelly?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you?
I'm really well. And John Martellaro, how are you?
I'm good as well.
Awesome. I'm glad to have both of you here. And
you say that now.
I say that now. And I feel like on some level, I'm really leaning into the curveball because of one of the topics that I really want to talk about today.
Yes, you are.
But we're all grown-ups here, sort of. And we'll just see how this goes.
All right.
So here's the deal. Sonos, they put together this really elaborate study. And the study goes into the effects that playing music out loud for individuals and groups has.
And by out loud, what you mean is not in your own headphones, but
right. Speakers
out in a room where everyone can hear it.
Correct. And so it was a 2-week study, 30,000 people involved across, I believe, 8 different countries. And it's actually kind of cool what they did just from a technology standpoint.
What did they do?
What they did was, of course, they used their own Sonos streaming music players.
Yes.
Which were able to play Apple Music, even though mm-hmm. it wasn't officially available until today. By the way, today, Apple Music became available and the study was released today. That's not a coincidence. But
absolutely not. But I will point out that the Sonos system is Matt Geekgab approved. So for people who are interested, I know Dave Hamilton has one that he enjoys.
Yes, that's very true. Okay, so they use Sonos music players. Then they put iBeacons around people's homes so that they could track where people are and how long they stay in certain areas.
Okay.
And then everyone wore an Apple Watch, and including kids. So like five years old and up, everyone okay. had on an Apple Watch so that they could monitor physical responses. And then everyone had an iPhone so that there would be something that they could link the Apple Watch to. And then, of course, control the Sonos player. And then what they did was they had an independent research group do the study for them. They brought in an expert in neurology and the effects of music on the brain and had him supervise the entire study. And what they found was that, just generally speaking, people were happier. People spent more time with the people that matter to them. They interacted more. They had more fun performing just routine things like making dinner or cleaning up the house, doing other chores. And they found that people were more likely just to tell each other that they love them. They also found that people were inspired by songs to tell that special someone in their life, "I love you." And the big thing for a lot of people, 67% more sex.
Now, this was all music, not just Barry White, right?
Correct. This was
Marvin
all music.
Gaye, like 24/7. Okay.
Right. So yeah. So all music, and that's kind of substantial. So my big takeaway is it doesn't matter if you're using Sonos, an Apple Music or another streaming music service, if you're playing the radio. Well, I'm not a big radio fan because commercials kind of break up your groove.
Yeah, they do harsh or mellow.
Yeah, CDs, whatever. However it is that you want to listen to your music, that's what matters, listening to music together.
You know, this is cool because it confirms what we already knew, but what I'm interested in is the science of it. Why does this work? And I mean, the first step is to quantify and understand it, of course. Mm-hmm. But the next step to my mind is to figure out why. It sort of reminds me of this business of how smells can evoke memories. And maybe there's some physiological situation where part of your brain, your hippocampus or something, is stimulated, memories are evoked, and there's endorphins are generated in your brain. And, you know, the science of it would be fascinating to explore deeper.
Oh, absolutely. And the doctor that they brought in to supervise the entire study, that's exactly the kind of stuff he's working on. So I'm sure he was really excited, like truly excited,
yeah,
to get to participate in this, because it got him a lot of data that he wouldn't have otherwise had.
Right. You got to have the data first.
Yep. And my question about this was, were they using research kits, since this was all Apple gear? If they were using research kit to collect all of this data, because that would be, to me, that would be really interesting, because we haven't seen a whole lot about the results of using research kit. Like, we've heard people mention that they're using it in some sort of study that they're doing, but so far I haven't seen anything that's been a real interesting presentation of data that was collected via research kit. So I would be curious about that, which was the only thing that I didn't get out of this. I think it's awesome. And honestly, I'm not surprised, because I know that one of the things that I like is, I mean, I like to play music basically all the time. If I'm working and I'm by myself in my office and I'm the only one here, I will still play. I will play music. It's different music depending what I'm doing, but I tend to have music playing very, very often. And because it makes me feel better, I get sort of unhappy, I guess, you know. And so it was really, to me, it was nice to see numbers attached to some of this stuff. Like, I love music when I'm making dinner. I have, in fact, an iPod which is dedicated to the task of making sure that there's music wherever I want to be, because I have a little speaker.
What about a writing playlist? I have a writing playlist called My Workday.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. there's only special songs in there that help me get into the right mood for writing. Mm-hmm. And as time goes on, I refine that list and get rid of songs that jar me and improve, add songs that I find are special that help me think. And there's some music where I just can't think and I can't mm-hmm. function. And there's some music that just makes me kind of drift and philosophize.
I have film score playlists, because nice. I love to hear music. I want it to be familiar music to me, but I do not want it to have vocals to sing along to, because then I sing along and then my brain is not where I need it to be.
Exactly.
So my work stuff is much like my earlier years. The bulk of my day has been scored by John Williams. And then,
excellent.
Yeah. And then the rest, it's a pretty John Williams heavy playlist. And then, there's some Michael Giacchino and some other folks in there as well. And then, I also have like stuff for other times. Like, I have a playlist for when I'm doing housework, because it's all peppy, upbeat music that makes me not want to sit down and give up in the middle of whatever task it is I'm doing.
I have an exercise playlist. There's a lot of Bond music.
Mm-hmm. I have one of those too.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And I have some Pirates of the Caribbean in my playlist, which is kind of fun, because when it comes up randomly, whatever I'm writing gets very exciting.
Excellent.
I got to tell you a funny story.
Yeah.
When I'm driving, I can't listen to vocals because the words detract from the part of my brain that's analyzing the road situation. I can only listen to music when I'm driving. My wife, on the other hand, cannot listen to music when she's driving. She turns on NPR. And I don't understand how she can listen to NPR and drive at the same time, but it suits her.
And I don't understand how you listen to music without words, because then how do you have karaoke if you can't sing along?
Exactly.
Well, if I sang along while I was writing, I would be distracted.
No, I'm talking about driving.
Oh. Driving, I do instrumentals and vocals, and I do sing along when I'm driving, as Dave Hamilton can attest when we were coming back from Breckenridge.
Yep.
Also, Brian Chaffin and Dave and I were all singing along my playlist in the car when we were driving back.
That's awesome. All right. So my playlist when I'm writing, it's typically electronica.
Mm-hmm.
And no lyrics, which mm-hmm. is important, because as soon as you get lyrics in, it pulls me out of what I'm writing and I'm focusing on the lyrics.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at.
And when I'm done writing, then it depends on my mood, what I'm going to listen to. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes it'll be classic rock.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it'll be like alternative rock. And but a lot of times it's classical music.
Writing is related mm-hmm. to memory. You have to recall events, you know, special things that Steve Jobs said during some keynote event or something like that, or some story that you read a long time ago. And when you're writing, that hippocampus control of your memory and your emotions has to be stimulated. Otherwise, you can't be self-referential and allude to things that relate to what you're trying to say.
For me, I find it really, like I said, it was really nice to see, you know, people were happier. They spent more time together. It was easier to do chores because that's what I do. Like when it's, if I have some housework to do that I'm really not feeling, then I make sure I have the right music on for that and it makes it tolerable. Or if I know I have to spend a bunch of time doing something that's going to be in the garage. Like when I was building my man-eating wreath, for example, and I was out in the garage and it was like 50 degrees in the garage, and it was cold and it wasn't where I wanted to be. Then
you can't have Bond music running while you're doing housework because you're thinking, well, I remember that movie, I remember that music, and he had a Walther PPK, and he was
and now you dive over the couch instead of vacuuming.
Yeah, and I'm here with the vacuum cleaner. Yeah. So.
Yeah, see, my problem is, I just go, there's an evil agent under the couch, so clearly I can't vacuum. That's what I end up with Bond music.
Oh, clearly,
yeah.
Yes.
So it was fun to see that, like, what I have found for myself, which is that if I have music on to do something sucky, then it sucks dramatically less. It was really nice to see that justified.
Yes. Hey, a nice little tip. Jazz is great when you're building with Lego bricks. Not smooth jazz. I mean, proper jazz, real jazz.
Nice. This is good to know.
Yep. So keep that little note handy.
Another thing that I have found in doing some research on some of this is that there is some music that, you know, like we're talking about, like I can't, like we want to listen to classical music or music that doesn't have any lyrics. There have been studies that if you are a person who is very easily distracted, or if you are a diagnosed ADD, ADHD person, that Baroque era classical music can actually help sort of settle your brain. I don't know why, and I never read about the science of it, but I tried it and it really does help. So
fascinating.
Yeah, so that was another thing that I thought was really nice from this, was some more quantifiable research around some stuff like that. I'd read there had been some scientific studies. So if you're somebody who finds that you feel like you absolutely cannot sit still, try a little Baroque music and see if that sort of helps chill your brain out a little bit.
I've heard stories about people playing classical music, Beethoven and Bach, for their kids in the crib, and it helps.
Yeah.
How about Morcheeba ahead of foreplay? Just tossing that out there.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. Yeah. All right. So what we know is now is that we have more evidence to back up what we've known all along, which is music can get you in the mood. And whatever the mood needs to be for whatever you're doing, music can get you in the mood. And I think that's awesome. And I think it's also really cool that a lot of Apple technology was used to pull this study together. I'm going to shoot Apple a message and ask them about ResearchKit, because what I'm hoping is that ResearchKit was used and Sonos just forgot to mention it.
Jeff, does this mean you're going to be changing the TDO intro music?
To what? Could.
But to what?
Get us in the mood.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit of Barry White coming on.
We'll take your requests, listeners.
That's baby. Right. That's right. Wow. Okay. Hey, we have time to talk about something else.
Awesome.
So,
let's do it.
There's a report out that says that the federal government plans to treat Google's self-driving vehicles as if they are licensed drivers. Now, this is a big step forward for Google, because one of the big issues has been, regardless of how well self-driving cars can actually navigate, what about the laws relating to cars on the road?
Right.
And so this will help address that issue, which is good for Google. But now,
but only sort of.
Yeah. Well, now I'm really wondering about the whole thing with the car and legal responsibility. So it's so the car's being treated as if it were a licensed driver.
Okay.
What happens when the car's involved in an accident?
Mm-hmm.
And then who gets a ticket? Do you write a ticket to the car?
Well, I think the key there is that if you have a car that's licensed, it's as if you loaned your car to another licensed driver. And so you have equal footing there. So all the insurance rules and liability rules would continue to apply, because it's the same thing as if you tossed your keys to a friend and said, hey, drive me home from the bar.
But if your friend gets a ticket while driving you home or is involved in an accident or something, and there's some sort of action to be taken, it can be taken against your friend. How do you write a ticket to a car? How do you find fault in an insurance accident if it's a car and not you?
We talked about it in the pre-show, and I think the solution to that is an interface between... No, I think it has to be an agreement between the insurance companies and the car companies, where the insurance company says, here are the standards your car has to meet before we will issue insurance. Mm-hmm. And if you can't buy insurance for the car, you're not going to buy the car. So right. The insurance company says you have to have a car that's 7.9s reliable. And the insurance and the car company says, here's testing to prove that it's 7.9s reliable, 0.9999999. And then the insurance company says, okay, we'll insure it. And then when the guy goes into, or the customer goes into the car dealership to buy the car, he can get insurance on the car because of that groundwork that's been laid.
All right, so now I've taken care of insurance, and that seems like a totally reasonable way to address that. Mm-hmm. But what do you do when it comes time to deal with something that will be criminally or traffic infraction related to the vehicle, something where you would write someone a ticket for their action as a driver? And I think I came up with a solution to that. What you do is the same thing that you do with things like parking violations and red light cameras, where you have a strict liability for the vehicle owner. So it doesn't matter who's driving the car. The owner of the vehicle is responsible for whatever that traffic or parking or criminal infraction would be, and they get the ticket. So...
Technically incapable of violating the laws, which is why they're causing accidents, because they stop when the light turns yellow and they don't speed and they do all these things that are unpredictably safe.
Yes. But if you park the car somewhere or let it park itself, or your friend takes your car and parks it, your friend doesn't get the parking ticket. You get the parking ticket.
Right. And that's the thing that I'm trying to think of, is like, what kind of liability is that? Because if I were in the car and I parked it somewhere and they've changed the parking rules, you know, and the car gets a parking ticket, like, you know, that now, I find that very odd.
Actually, so. What would be cool is if there was a really up-to-date database of parking restrictions for everywhere. So you park your car.
Oh, yeah. The iBeacon tells the car, you can't park here.
Yeah. Or you're going to have to move in 20 minutes. And you don't realize it, but your car, 15 minutes later, it's like, okay, I have to move. So it pulls out of the parking space and go finds another, and then sends you a message. Hey, this is where I am now. You didn't get a ticket. You're welcome.
I can't wait to see the facilities for overriding the car. You know, you're driving your wife to the hospital because she's just about ready to give birth, and you pull into the emergency zone and you're ready to leave the car there so you can get her into the wheelchair, and the car says, we can't park here. And you're going, oh, yes, we will.
Right. I feel like there's still a long way for this to go. And one of the examples that I saw, I think we were talking about it, maybe Jeff on the Big Show once over on British Tech Network, with self-driving cars, is like, there's a kid in the street and there's nowhere for you to go. Like it, to keep, you know, well, to dodge the kid, you would go up on the sidewalk. And, you know, would the car do that? And so finding, you know, I feel like there's still a whole lot of decision making that I do aside from the music that plays in my car, because karaoke is important. There's still a lot of decisions I make while I'm driving that I do not feel comfortable trusting to a machine.
Well, what happens is, as I talked about in the pre-show with Dave and Brian and Jeff, was that you unplug the intelligence module from the car and you plug it into the family robot and put a suit on him, and it goes into the courtroom and explains how its algorithm insisted that it took the minimum risk and the maximum protection of human life according to the algorithms that were programmed in, and the judge says, dismissed.
Well, and then my question is, okay, so let's say that there is a defect in the software and every third four-way stop, it disregards the sign and just rolls through the intersection.
Oh, good luck proving the flaw in the software, right? But you know, army of programmers, Dan.
But let's say that there is one, and that that's what happened, and then there was an accident. So are you at fault for Google's driving software not working properly? Mailing a ticket to Google isn't going to get you anywhere. But
we just went through the same thing with Toyota with this unintended acceleration thing. One of my wife's friends had that happen to her, where her car took control,
yeah,
and she put both feet on the brake pedal. Nothing happened. She pulled the emergency brake. Nothing happened. So she turned the steering wheel into the curb and ran up into some bushes to stop the car. And Toyota said, it was driver error.
Yeah.
So we've been down that legal road before.
Which is not. I mean, so, well, but that's my question is, when the car is making a significantly larger number of those decisions, then where exactly is that liability going to be? So I still am not excited about handing all of that over to a machine yet. So there's that too.
Well, you know, it's sort of like Hyperloop. I was talking to my wife about Hyperloop this morning. You get into a tube and you're hurtling along at 1,000 feet per second, and if there's one little crack or there's a minor earthquake that goes unnoticed and the tube is fractured, or there's some foreign material in there, or there's sabotage, and all of a sudden here you are, you're moving along at 1,000 feet per second in 10,000 different pieces because the thing has exploded and crashed, and it's sobering to think about that. But the same thing has happened with airliners. You know, if you 100 years ago, if you told somebody you were going to get into a tube and fly 700 miles or 500 miles an hour in the sky, they'd say, oh, think of all the bad things that could happen. The engine could fail, you could crash, you could hit by lightning, you could fly into birds,
you could melt.
We engineer our way out of those things until we have a sufficient level of reliability that everybody agrees on. And then once we get to that engineering level of agreement, then everybody goes, yeah, it's safe to fly to, you know, 7 9s of reliability. Yeah. And then we'll do the same thing with cars.
But I'm still leaving that choice to a human being for the most part.
Well, it'll be interesting in rare cases that will show up in court. But by and large, most people will get through it, I predict. And we'll learn with the technology, and a few spectacular court cases will refine the legalities.
Yep. I think you're right, John. And hey, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up.
Oh, that was so much fun.
It was a lot of fun. So, John, thank you for being here today.
You're very welcome.
And Kelly, thank you for being here too.
Of course. My pleasure.
And listeners, thank you for joining us. And I'm curious, what music do you listen to, you know, when you listen? Let me know. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you again tomorrow.
John and Kelly Show is over.